Who's back on the back table? Kaiz and I have been reading it at night together, and we've been reading it on our own too. But this week she said, we read the part where Elijah, he looked off in the distance and he saw a storm cloud coming. Right? We see that sometimes, these storm clouds as they're advancing. And he took his robe and he tucked it into his belt and he ran ahead of the storm cloud all the way to Jezreel. And Kaiza said, gosh, you know what? That would make a really good movie. Right? And in fact, a lot of the stuff that we read this week would make excellent movie, because there's just these really fantastic and outstanding events that occurred. And I think that often it's our inclination to say, well, these are just myths, right? This didn't write. This is so outlandish and so fantastic that there's no way that this could have ever happened. But we need to remember that the reason that these things are so fantastic and so amazing is because these are the works of God, that God sends a message to his people, and he does it through these really fantastic and amazing events. You know, I believe that God is real, and I believe that he reigns, and I believe that he works through us, and he sends us messages, and sometimes he does it in a whirlwind. And sometimes he does it in a whisper. And we just need to remember that as we're reading through the Acts of the prophets. But they are sent to give us a message, and they are real events that occurred. So they are. This week we talked a lot about prophets in the story. And I'm missing my thing. Oh, we talked about prophets. And the point of the prophets was to send a message to the nations, to God's people. They're to send a message to us sometimes. Sometimes it's the message that they send might not be for us, and sometimes it is. But their point simply is to send messages. And often, overwhelmingly actually, when the prophets are sent to the nation of Israel, to God's people, often the purpose or the message that they send is this message. This is the first commandment, right? You shall have no other gods before me. Overwhelmingly, when the prophets bring a message to the people, it's to have no other gods before me. Alright? God's not stupid, right? He knows that this isn't like some Greek mythology where it's him next to all these other competing gods. He knows that he's not at battle with other gods up in the heavenly realms. All right? Now, there are spiritual beings, of course. There are demons we read about and angels in the Bible. But he is the supreme. He is supreme over all, and he reigns over all. He is the one true God. So what does this mean, to have no other gods before me? Well, for the ancient Israelites, they were worshiping gods, and we'll see that today. Like, they made actual items, and they said, this is our God. This is something that we'll worship. God isn't saying, well, this item is a god, and we're just competing. He's saying that this is not a god, but you are not to hold it in front of you before me. It applies to us too, right? We can have gods. We can have things that are in headship over us, things that we look to trust. I think we often do that, that as we sin, that we bring things that and put them into God's place, where we trust in other things other than the one true God. We should orient our entire lives to getting this commandment right. You know, Jesus said that he came and he fulfilled the law. He fulfilled the law so that we live by his grace, that God sees us as righteous by his blood alone. But he didn't abolish the law. He did not come to abolish the law. So this is something that we should aim to live our lives as we have no other gods before us. Because without this command, we cannot please God. As Jesus said, you can't serve two masters, because you'll hate one and probably hate the other too, frankly, that you can't serve two masters. So we need to always keep this message of you shall have no other gods before me is very much a true message that holds for us, very much holds for us today. Just a little bit of background. We read about this a lot yesterday. After Solomon died, which we read about last week, God made Jeroboam king of the northern kingdom. Remember, Jeroboam was one of the officials of Solomon, and God made him king over the northern kingdom. So the northern kingdom here is everything sort of north of Benjamin, everything except for Benjamin and Judah. And it was called Israel. Don't get confused with this, because prior to Solomon, like, we called that nation Israel too, right? We call that Israel. The United Kingdom was also called Israel. But now that the kingdom is split into the Northern Kingdom, which included 10 tribes, and the Southern Kingdom, we now call that Northern Kingdom Israel. And of course, we call that Southern Kingdom Judah, which contains the tribe of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin. Just a quick little reminder for you, right? Those tribes come about. Those are the sons of Jacob, whose name was called Israel. And that's why we called that United Kingdom Israel. Y'all with me on this? Okay, so here we have the 12 tribes. These were all allotted in Joshua. In our story, they didn't get into all how the lands were allotted. But you can read about this in Joshua, where the lands were given to all these various tribes. And then also Jerusalem is in Judah, or it's actually in Benjamin, but it now comes into the southern kingdom. So Jerusalem has the southern kingdom, or rather, the southern kingdom now has Jerusalem, which is the city where the temple is. All right, now Rehoboam, who is the son of Solomon, as we read last week, he became the king of the southern kingdom, which included those tribes of Judah and Benjamin. During the time of the divided kingdom, when we had the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom, many of the kings were idolatrous. We'll read about that in just a minute. And you read about it this week. But they would surround themselves with wives and advisors from outside. And often those wives or advisors would mislead them. Actually, I think that the kings, they did it of their own will. That they would take their people and they would lead them in worship of idols. Both kingdoms did this. At some point or another, both the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. But the northern kingdom, as we learned this week, was particularly rebellious. Jeroboam forbade the Levites. The Levites were one of those tribes, but they were a priestly tribe. And they didn't have an allotment of land. They were sort of spread all throughout the United Kingdom because they were the priests. And they were there to make sacrifices for the people and intercede between God and the people. So the Levites, Jeroboam forbade the Levites from sacrificing in the northern kingdom, in Israel, and he assigned his own priest. And then the Levites left. We read about this in 2 Chronicles 11. It says, then are the Levites even abandoned their pasture lands and property and came to Judah and Jerusalem because Jeroboam and his sons had rejected them as priests of the Lord. Jeroboam said, we don't need you Levites anymore. We have our own priest. Says that he appointed his own priests for the high places and for the goat and calf idols he had made. So Jeroboam made these idols out of probably gold, goats and calves, and that's what they worshipped. And he said, Levites, we don't need you. You just get out of here. And they all fled to Judah. Now, there is some good in Judah, as we read about last week. It says, because Rehoboam humbled himself, the Lord's anger turned from him, and he was not totally destroyed. Indeed, there was some good in Judah. Just to remind you from last week, Jeroboam, remember, we sort of had this idea that Jeroboam loved the people, but he hated God. And Rehoboam, well, not very good with the people, right? He was very mean to them, but he loved God in the end. And there was some good in Judah. Now here we have a little timeline of the kings and the prophets. And we saw a lot of these names. Today we're going to look at Ahab and Elijah primarily in the northern kingdom. Remember northern kingdom? Almost without exception, those kings were bad. Right? Almost without exception, those kings were bad. Jeroboam we see in the yellow up top, Baasha, and then on to Ahab. The prophets here, they prophesied to different nations. So for example here, we have Shemaiah and Azariah. Those were prophets to the northern kingdom. And we had Iddo. As Bill says, if you don't know how to say the name, just say it with great confidence. And then everybody will think that you know what you're saying. All right. The prophets for the southern kingdom included Iddo, Obed, Micaiah, what have you. So that sort of gives you a little perspective about where we are, the kings and as they were laid out. And each of the kings had prophets. And sometimes those prophets actually ran over several kingdoms, two or more kingdoms, as they prophesied and brought these messages to the people. Okay? As I said, almost without exception, the prophets were rejected. Okay. In the southern kingdom, that wasn't always true. Sometimes we had kings that would accept the prophets, and you'll read about this in Kings and Chronicles, and they'll say that this king so-and-so, he walked in the ways of David. That means that he was a good king, that he worshipped the one true God. And then other kings will say, this king did evil in the sight of the Lord. A lot of the southern kings did that. They did evil in the sight of the Lord. Usually that means that they were worshipping false gods, that they were making these goats and calves, and usually that's what that means. Okay? Without exception, however, the northern kingdom, Israel, those kings, without exception, were bad kings. That means that they misled their people in worshiping these false idols. Without exception, except for one. There was one prophet that was the people completely subjected themselves to, and that was the prophet Jonah. Now that should perk up your ears a little bit, right? Why Jonah, why does that perk up your ears? Because Jonah ministered to who? If you've seen VeggieTales, right? Ministered to the Ninevites. The Ninevites, right? But the Ninevites, those weren't God's chosen people. So here, the only people that truly subjected themselves to the prophets and to the message of God were these Ninevites. And they stopped hitting one another with fishes or whatever it was that they were doing. And they repented and they turned to follow the one true God. So he was the only prophet in the northern kingdom that was truly redeemed, or truly accepted rather. Now Elijah comes to the northern kingdom, comes to Israel, and he has a message for them. Because Israel, like I said, the people there have no, they don't have faith because their king is misleading them in worshiping these false idols. In 1 Kings 16, we read about Ahab, who Elijah acted as a prophet under the rule of Ahab. And if you want to turn to 1 Kings, that's fine. We're going to be in 1 Kings now for a little while. This is 1 Kings 16. Let's see. It says, in the 38th year of Asa, king of Judah, Ahab, son of Omri, became king of Israel. And he reigned in Samaria over Israel 22 years. Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. Ahab was a bad, bad king. He was an evil king. He was also very fanatical. We read about him and sort of the things that he did, and paired with his wife, who was Jezebel, a foreigner who worshipped these false gods, the Asherah, which we'll get to in a second. Evil, evil king. In fact, that's why Herman Melville, y'all read Moby Dick? Herman Melville wanted to capitalize on that image that King Ahab had, that is, of an evil king, when he named one of his lead characters in Moby Dick, Captain Ahab. Right, Captain Ahab likewise was evil and fanatical. And that's why Melville named his lead character Ahab, named after the king Ahab to Israel. And some of the things that he did included setting up altars. It says in that same chapter, verse 32, he set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Now, Baal was sort of a general term for gods. It sort of changed as to who it was over the millennia. But the point is that this was a false god. This was a fake god, if you will. So, one that wasn't existing, but they prayed to nonetheless. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to arouse the anger of the Lord, the God of Israel, than did all the kings of Israel before him. All the kings before him, they had been really bad, but this was the worst of the bad. Ahab was a bad, bad king. Evil, evil king. So, let's see. Elijah then was sent to this northern kingdom. And Elijah, pretty famous guy, right? Y'all have heard of Elijah? Elijah was the only human being other than Jesus Christ that bodily ascended to heaven. And we read about that this week. Elijah also appeared, not just in the Old Testament, but he appeared in the New Testament as well, at the Transfiguration, right? He appeared there with Jesus and a few of the apostles and Moses at the Transfiguration when the glory of God and Jesus Christ shone through. So Elijah was there. For some reason, Elijah was very important in God's history of the world. And we saw these just really amazing events that Elijah participated in. We're going to look at one now. But if you haven't read this week's reading, I really recommend that you go back. It doesn't take that long, really. And read about some of the really cool things that Elijah did. Now, God sent Elijah to Ahab. Ahab, this really, really evil king, God sends Elijah, this prophet, to Ahab. And with this message, Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word." So first of all, Elijah's bringing this evil, or this bad message to Ahab. What does he expect to happen? It's like, this king Ahab, he's just going to kill me. He's done this before. He's going to slaughter me. And so Elijah runs away, and God protects him and provides for him. But then also he brings this message that this drought is going to come at my word, and it's not going to end for 3 years. 3 years. So he has this really bad message. And then what follows was, of course, 3 years with no rain. There was no rain in the land. And the people presumably had no food, or very little food, and very little water. We read about, during this period, how God provided for Elijah. We did this in VBS. Y'all remember? With the ravens, they brought food to Elijah. He drank from the brook for a little while until it dried up. Okay, and we also see some other miraculous events that occurred during these time between when the drought started and when it ended. All right, but we had 3 years with no rain. I think the people were afraid, don't you think? Because their friends were dying. Their friends were dying of starvation, or they were dying of illness that was associated with just not enough to eat. They didn't know where their next meal was coming from. They were terribly afraid. I think that if we were in that same situation, that we would be afraid, right? Would you be afraid if you didn't have food or water to drink? So the question is, of course, in their fear, where did they turn? And under the rule of King Ahab, they turned to these false gods. And they said, well, if I pray to the Asherah, or if I pray to the Baals, then that God will bring me food. He will bring me water. And so, of course, that's a question for us, too. When we're afraid, maybe we don't have a 3-year drought, but maybe when we lose our job, or we have strife in our relationships, where do we turn in that case? Do we turn to those things that we have placed in headship over us? Because we have things in headship over us that aren't God, right? We do. I do. It's like a constant battle to keep them out of the way. Or do we turn to the one true God? Where do you turn when you're afraid? Where do you turn when you're afraid? Now, after 3 years, Elijah goes to Ahab. He tells of this coming rain. But I think really the true, to tell him about this rain that's going to come, but really the true purpose is to declare the power of God in this time of drought. In 1 Kings 18, it says, after a long time, in the third year, the word of the Lord came to Elijah, go and present yourself to Ahab, and I will send rain on the land. So Elijah went to present himself to Ahab. What follows is this. It's like this battle of the bands, right? Which God is going to be better? Which God is going to declare himself powerful? And we see this in 1 Kings 18 again. Ahab goes to meet Elijah, and when he saw Elijah, he said to him, is that you, you troubler of Israel? Elijah says, I have not made trouble for Israel, but you and your father's family have. You have abandoned the Lord's commands and have followed the Baals. Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table. So they all come together at Mount Carmel. 1,000 people, thousands of people. We have 1,000 prophets almost. And then we have Elijah, the one prophet of the God of Israel. And then we have lots of onlookers. Thousands of people come together for this event. And Elijah tells them to all come. Now what happens next? You may have heard it. You may have heard this account, or you read it this week. But they get two bulls. Elijah says, you can pick the one that you want. Baal worshippers. And so they pick their bull. They build up their little altar. They build an altar. They take their sticks and their wood, and they place it there. They slaughter the bull. They put it on the altar. And then they wait. And Elijah says, you pray to your God, Baal, and he will set light, and he will consume this sacrifice in fire. And so they do that. They do it for hours. Hours and hours and hours. Elijah actually begins to taunt them. I think this is funny, but I know that it wasn't funny at the time. But reading it now, it seems funny because, I don't know, sarcasm? I guess he's using sarcasm. All right. At noon, after almost a whole day of them trying to get this fire to light by worshiping their god Baal, at noon, Elijah began to taunt them. Shout louder, he said. Surely he is a god. Perhaps he is deep in thought, or busy, or traveling. Maybe he is sleeping and must be awakened. So they shouted louder and slashed themselves with swords and spears. They cut their bodies. They cut themselves, as was their custom, until their blood flowed. Midday passed, and they continued their frantic prophesying until the time for the evening. So this goes on all day. All day this goes on. And finally Elijah says, all right, you're done. And he tells them to take water. All right, he comes and he rebuilds the altar. He takes 12 stones. That represents the 12 tribes of Israel. He takes the 12 stones and he builds them. He puts some wood. And then he tells them, bring a bucket of water over here. So they bring bucket after bucket after bucket of water. And they pour it onto the altar. And so it's just surrounded with water. It's all the wood is soaking wet. The bowl is soaking wet. It's all surrounded with this like moat of water. And then he prays to God. At the time of the sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again. And then, with a little fanfare, just no slashing of his body, no shouting, just this simple prayer. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the sacrifice, the wood, the stones, and the soil, and also licked up the water in the trench. So we have this battle of the bands, and God, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, shows his power, demonstrates his power to these people, to these prophets of Baal who are worshiping this false god. You know, when I first became a Christian, the idea of the jealousy of God did not sit well with me. The idea that God is a jealous God and that he is an angry God did not sit well. And we saw it a lot. Like, I read it a lot, and not in just the Old Testament, but in the New Testament, too. I mean, just a couple of verses down from that first commandment that we read earlier in Exodus 23, you shall not bow down to them or worship them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. The God that we serve, the God that reigns over all things, is jealous, and he is angry. And I didn't understand that. I just didn't really understand what that means and how he who is holy and good can be jealous and angry. And so a pastor at the time who was discipling me, he said, you know what, Chad, you need to take that and just put it up in the back of your closet, that idea. And then one day God will teach you what that means. And I think that just in the past year that he's really taught me what that means, his jealousy and his anger. And we saw it this week in Hosea. Now, Hosea was a prophet to the northern kingdom, and his life, God gave his life to demonstrate the jealousy of God for Israel. I think that's really amazing. I have to really thank God for Hosea, that he would give his whole life to demonstrate this image of jealousy that God has for his people. In Hosea 1, it says, when the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, go marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her, for like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. God told Hosea to go marry a prostitute so that he would be an image of what God is like to the nation of Israel, where God is the faithful husband and Israel is this prostitute. And he lived out his life like this, married to this prostitute, as an image of the relationship between God and Israel. In Hosea 2, she has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold which they used for Baal. God was giving his people this silver and gold and grain, and they were turning around and using it to worship this god Baal. It's like he was a faithful husband that was married to this prostitute. And so therein is my problem, right? That when I look at the jealousy and anger, I look at the jealousy or the anger of an unrighteous man, of a man like myself, or the jealousy of a vindictive boyfriend who's always calling his lady on the telephone and saying, where are you and what are you doing and why aren't you here? Okay? I don't look at it as the jealousy of a faithful husband that's married to a prostitute who goes out night after night after night, and yet he still loves her and he still provides for her, and she continues to do that over and over and over and over again. So a really beautiful image of the jealousy of God and the anger of God in the book of Hosea. And yet in Hosea 3, we see, the Lord said to me, "Go show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another man and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods." There's this David Crowder song. The Kaiser gave me this CD. And this David Crowder song, it's How He Loves. You ever heard that song? I've just learned it, but it's a great song, and it really talks to this issue. It goes a little bit like this. It goes, "He is jealous for me, loves like a hurricane. I am the tree bending beneath the weight of his wind and mercy." God is jealous for me. He is a jealous God, and He wants all of me. And He wants me to serve Him and to love Him and to enjoy Him. God is jealous for you too, right? He is a jealous God. And when He gives you things and you turn around and you worship other things, that makes Him angry. Just like the Israelites, though, He still loves you, that He has bought you, that while we were still sinners, even as we turn away from Him, He died for us. That Jesus Christ died for us and made us His sons and His daughters. That He is jealous for you, and He is jealous for me. So, I'm wrapping up now. Just give me one more minute. But Mike and I just finished the Lord of the Rings trilogy. Right, the Lord of the Rings trilogy, the Return of the King. And in the end, towards the end, sort of after the climax, when the Ring of Power has been destroyed, and Frodo and Sam and some others, they're headed back into the Shire, and they encounter some of their friends. And during the time that Sauron, the evil... I'm sorry if y'all don't know what I'm talking about. But during the time of Sauron, the evil lord, the land has just become a mess. Alright, because these ruffians have come in, these men of Sauron, men of Saruman have come in, and they destroyed the land. And they destroyed the land, they cut down the trees, they've torn down the houses, they've killed people, they've imprisoned people, they've taken away all the tobacco. There's no tobacco in the Shire, that's a big deal apparently. But they run into these people and they say, "Frodo, Samwise, don't go back to the Shire. It's a mess there." And they say, "No. There's a king. The king has come back, and he heals and he rules. And he's coming here, and he's going to set this straight." And so, in the big scheme of history, where we have the fall, or the creation, and the fall, and the redemption, and then we have the restoration, that the king has come, and his kingdom will come. That's what we pray for in the Lord's Prayer, right? His kingdom come, on earth as it is in heaven, when He will reign. So our hope is in Jesus Christ. Our hope is in that restoration. Please pray with me. Dear Lord, we do hope in Your coming. We do hope that Your kingdom will become and Your way on earth as it is in heaven. Lord, we just end in the way that You have taught us to pray. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be Thy name. Thy kingdom come, Thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not in temptation, but deliver us from evil. For Thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory.